So this is the third evening of our four-week series on the Four Noble Truths. And tonight I'll talk about the third noble truth and introduce the fourth. But before I start, I just wanted to check in with you and see if any of you who were here last week experimented with some of the things I suggested with the observing, wanting, the second noble truth, observing the wanting, and not acting on it, and see if anybody has any comments about that, if anybody experimented with that. Yeah.
Well, I experimented with it, and I just felt it every time. I had a choice, and I made a choice, and that most of the time I chose against whatever I wanted. It wasn't something that I was just doing in the context of the discussion last week, but that most of the time I just decide, no, I really don't want a hot fudge sundae or whatever it is. You know, it's just a fleeting desire that goes away anyway, but that there's always a choice, and for some reason or other, the desire goes away. That's, so it was interesting to observe.
That's great. That's beautiful. I'm so glad you saw that. You said, I'll just repeat it just in case people didn't hear the early part of what she said. She said she noticed that in looking at wanting, that she noticed that she had a choice about it when the wanting came up. If she saw the wanting, she had a choice about whether or not to follow through on it. And often she chose not to, because it really ended up being something she didn't particularly want. It was just a fleeting thought. And that she noticed that the wanting, for some reason or other, would just disappear. Part of the reason wanting disappears is because it's like anything. Everything disappears. Everything passes away. So it's just the nature of all experience, whether it's a desire or a sight or a sound, a thought, a mood, everything has that nature. So the fact that you notice that is really, it indicates that you're seeing exactly what's happening in reality. You notice that it disappeared. That's great. Thanks. Anyone else have any comments? Yeah.
I found that during practice, when I tried to, watch my urges to either move or swallow or get up, some things were a lot more challenging. Like itches were really challenging. I think I could only do that one time, and then I thought, this is torture. I have to scratch. But I felt like at least I was honoring that and not, you know, torturing myself.
So what did the wanting feel like to you?
It became a bodily kind of challenge, you know, a very tense feeling in the body, mm-hmm. when I kept myself from doing something that would have been more of an automatic,
yes.
kind of reaction. Uh-huh. I was thinking about it. Sometimes it passed, and other times it just got very, very noticeable.
Strong.
Yes, itches were the worst, I think.
Yeah, itches are very challenging, but on the other hand, itches are great places to practice. I love to practice with itches because, as far as I know, nobody has ever died from an itch. So, you know, you can really kind of be with it and know, you know, it's not like a pain in the knee or something where you're worried about damaging your body. It just drives you nuts. You know, so you really can take the opportunity to see what it feels like to be driven nuts and notice the reactivity. So it is very challenging. It is. So I honor the fact that you were able to do it once. That's great. Did the itch ever go away that time?
Yes, it did. The first time, but then, you know, the second time was this is not going to work this time.
Yeah, it can get very, very precise sometimes. You know, I've noticed itches, it's just like it's almost like it's one single cell firing or something. You can get down to this one little tiny point that's going bing, 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 bing. It's very, very intense. So, yeah, but thank you for sharing that. That she was referring to the second exercise that I brought up. And for those of you who want to hear what I suggested, and I'm repeating this just in case you might want to try it sometime. What I suggested was to explore this urge of wanting by exploring the urge to move in a sitting. And that could include any movement towards itching, scratching an itch, or moving because of pain, but just to explore the urge when you're sitting to move before you move. You've got that opportunity because you're in stillness to really feel that urge of wanting in the sitting. I also suggested that you might try waiting to get up, to not set a fixed period of time for the sitting, but wait to get up until a very strong urge to do so has come and gone three times. So you could just experiment with that. The very first time I tried that exercise for myself, I had been sitting 20 minutes, and I just knew I couldn't sit any longer than that. You know, it was not within the scope of what my body could do. But I tried the exercise, and the first urge came and went, and I just let it go, and it passed through. The second, the third urges came and went, and at the end of that time, it was 45 minutes. And I realized, oh, I guess I can sit for 45 minutes. And from then on, I just sat for 45 minutes. So it really helped me to understand that a lot of my, what I thought were my limitations were just in my own mind. So it was a really powerful exercise for me. Any other comments? Yeah.
Yes, my challenge is around
hold it like a snow cone.
around an emotional response to this letter that I'm getting from the government about the fact that they paid me too much money, and I just want you to read. And I have to give it all back, just like right now, and $15,000. And I keep going into fear, and I keep getting all the and then my mind says, you know, just stay with it and just do all that you can do. You have to wait. There's nobody to really see. There's just somebody out there writing these letters, and I can't. And this is real hard for me. I'm getting very fearful because I feel I don't have any power. And also I'm feeling that somehow I thought the government and everything. I thought that was a, I had a feeling that was maybe like a father or something. And they wouldn't do that. And I can't believe this, you know. And so I have to keep waiting. And if they say, do you want to just send the check back or a check or something? Or do you have a hearing? And so I said, you know, I could write in these papers, yes, well, I'll have a hearing because I wanted to tell somebody about this, you know. But anyway, that's my problem. But my whole body, and every once in a while I cramps.
Yeah. Oh, this is a very challenging, I mean, this is really, really challenging what you're talking about, because it really gets to the kind of core of not having control over our lives. I mean, it's very scary. You know, it's sometimes in a situation like this, we really have to respect how much we can do with the practice, you know, that we can pay attention as much as we can and be as compassionate as we can to ourselves for how difficult it is. We really have to bring compassion to ourselves because this is very challenging. You know, the practice is not going to solve the problem of finding the money. You know, it's just that. So, you know, we really just have to work with our reactivity to the situation. And it's such a scary thing that you're dealing with. That sometimes, you know, we don't have the reserves to face that fear, and it can be helpful at times like that to not try to be mindful of all the contraction and tension, but to find ways to help ourselves relax and let go, and to just be just to let ourselves release, because you know, it you're dealing with something very, very challenging. So find with as much compassion as you can ways to let your body relax. Maybe doing body scans. Did you get any relaxation with the guided meditation that I did earlier?
That's what helps.
That, yeah, let your...
Yoga and hiking.
Yeah.
All bodily
things. Yeah.
Acupuncture.
Keep doing those things. And as much as you can, when the tension and tightness comes up, be present for it as much as you can. But, you know, when you find yourself getting overwhelmed, do these other things for yourself. And be present while you do those things as well. I mean, you can cultivate mindfulness when you're in a hot bath, you know, relaxing. So, you know, be as present as you can for the compassion that you're giving to yourself, for letting yourself release it for a while, and for the bodily relaxation you're letting go. Let yourself be aware of those things too.
Yeah. I have to let go of, you know, why? What did I do? I mean, I'm so old now. How come this is happening now? You know, why? You know, what did I do? You know?
Yeah, the those trains of thoughts actually are not going to help you.
No. It's the way it is.
Yeah, it's the way it is, and you know, we need to work with the way it is, and you know, any kind of trying to figure out what we could have done different, or you know, forget it. Yeah, it's past, it's over. So
right now.
Right. It's like this. It's like this. Yeah. Oh, pass the back to the back.
Recently,
I'm not sure that one
did. Recently, I've been trying a different approach to dealing with anxiety, or when something comes up that like bothers me. In the past, I would try to like figure it out and like come up with a solution or make a decision that would fix something. And recently, I said, "Wait a second. What if I just... Oh, there it goes." I just tried to see, like, be aware of what was going on, but not come up with any solution, make any decision. And I found that actually, it gave me a real sense of release from anxiety. You know, I realized, okay, I'm not gonna figure out how to be anxiety free. I'm not gonna come up with all these decisions that are gonna make my life perfect. But sometimes I can just kind of try to be aware of what's going on. And just experience the emotions, but not make any decisions. And that actually has really helped me a lot recently. So
that's great. I'm really glad that you've discovered that, because that's the key, really. What I told somebody not too long ago is, change your question. Stop asking why and ask what. You know, why did this happen? You know, let go. Why? What can I? You know, it's not. Why did this happen? And how can I change this? It's what's happening now. What's the mood? What's the emotion? What are the feelings in the body? And as you say, you know, if you're not trying to figure out how to do anything about it in the future, also, but just to be with it. You know, sometimes what can happen is that the body has a kind of natural intelligence that will help you to figure out how to deal with things, like an intuition may bubble up if you're just present with the sensations of anxiety or fear or whatever. So that's wonderful, and thank you for sharing that. That's very
helpful. You're right. And like today when I was working, so I said, okay, no decision, no solution. I'm just gonna try to be aware of what's going on. So I just, you know, so I did my work, and I work at an ice cream store, and then just kind of being aware of what was going on. And then 15 minutes later, I said, oh, that's right. Yeah, I can just do that. You know, just kind of naturally just something.
It naturally
flowed. Yeah, naturally just flowed and evolved. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's right. And it was so simple. I just couldn't see it because I was so caught up in thinking about it. You know, like.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for sharing that. So I think I'll go ahead and start on tonight's topic, which is the third noble truth, the cessation of suffering. So this is the good news. After a couple of weeks of paying attention to suffering and desire and all of these difficult things, we get to explore the positive side of things. The Buddha didn't leave us with suffering. He actually said there's a way to end it. So the Buddhist framework of the Four Noble Truths uses a medical model, essentially. You know, when a doctor looks at a patient, he looks at four things. what is the illness, what causes the illness, and is there a cure for the illness, and what would the prescription be? How would it be cured? And so the Buddha's Four Noble Truths follow this model. The Buddha looked at the state of the world and of the state of the human condition and saw that there is suffering. The illness of the human condition is that there is suffering. The cause of that suffering he determined to be wanting things to be different than they are. And he declared that there is an end to that suffering. That illness can end. And the path leading us to the end of that suffering is the Noble Eightfold Path, which I'll talk about some this week and more next week. So what is the cessation of suffering? The word most often used for it in the Buddhist scriptures is the Sanskrit word is nirvana, and the Pali word is nibbana. And the clearest and most concise definition of that term given in the suttas is the absence of greed, hatred, and delusion. It's not described as some exalted state of bliss and exaltation. It's described as the absence of greed, hatred, and delusion. I'd like to read you a few selections from the suttas that describe it. Actually, it does sometimes say it's blissful, but so I'm going to read these. They're from all different places in the suttas. I pulled all of these different quotes together, and when I pulled them all together, I realized they read beautifully together. So I'm just going to read them as one thing. The extinction of greed, the extinction of hate, the extinction of delusion. This, indeed, is called nibbana. Enraptured with lust, enraged with anger, blinded by delusion, overwhelmed, with mind ensnared, man aims at his own ruin, at the ruin of others, at the ruin of both, and he experiences mental pain and grief. But if lust, anger, and delusion are given up, man aims neither at his own ruin, nor at the ruin of others, nor at the ruin of both, and he experiences no mental pain and grief. This is nibbana, immediate, visible in this life, inviting, attractive, and comprehensible to the wise. And for a disciple thus freed, in whose heart dwells peace, there is nothing to be added to what has been done, and naught more remains for him to do. Just as a rock of one solid mass remains unshaken by the wind, even so neither forms, nor sounds, nor odors, nor tastes, nor contacts of any kind, neither the desired nor the undesired, can cause such a one to waver. Steadfast is his mind, gained is deliverance. This is peace. This is exquisite. The resolution of all fabrications, the relinquishment of all acquisitions, the ending of craving, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. The suttas also give a number of similes for nibbana, and this is where we get some of those more happier or exquisite words. And one monk, Tanisaro Bhikkhu, also called Tanjef, he is a scholar and a practitioner, a monastic who lives in Southern California, and he's written a number of the books that we have for free distribution here. And he compiled a little, almost a poem of the similes of nibbana that were in the suttas. So I'll read this to you also. The unfashioned, the end, the effluentless, the true, the beyond, the subtle, the very hard to see, the ageless, permanence, the undecaying, the featureless, non-differentiation, peace, the deathless, the exquisite, bliss, solace, the exhaustion of craving, the wonderful, the marvelous, the secure, security, nibbana, the unafflicted, the passionless, the pure, release, non-attachment, the island, shelter, harbor, refuge, the ultimate. So as with the other noble truths, as I've mentioned in previous weeks, the Buddha had an action associated with each of the Four Noble Truths. The first noble truth, the truth of suffering, is meant to be understood, which means being present for it. In order to understand something, we have to be there for it. That's in any scenario. We need to understand anything. We have to witness it. We have to be present for it. We have to bring our attention to it. So understand suffering. The second noble truth, the truth of the cessation of suffering, is meant to be abandoned. The craving that leads to suffering is meant to be abandoned. And as I mentioned last week, that doesn't necessarily mean actively dropping it or pushing it away. It often simply means not acting on the wanting and letting it disappear on its own accord, as Linda mentioned earlier. The third noble truth, the truth of the cessation of suffering, is meant to be realized. So how do we realize the cessation of suffering? The cessation of suffering can only be realized in one place, and that is now, the present moment. It's actually the only place we can actually experience anything. And sometimes we forget that. If we're not in the present moment and mindful, we will not experience the end of suffering. One of my teachers, Joseph Goldstein, says that we actually experience moments of non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion many times during the day. They come and go all throughout the day. He calls them moments of non-clinging. He says they're just so subtle that we don't see them. The mind is habituated to seeing much more obvious phenomenon. So seeing these moments of non-clinging, I mean, it's not as simple as just turning our attention to the present moment. Because what we see when we turn our attention to the present moment is the habitual ways in which we're used to looking at reality. We're used to looking at more obvious things, and we're also going to experience the momentum of whatever has been happening in our lives. So when we turn our attention to the present moment, often what we see is not non-clinging, but we see wanting, we see aversion, we see suffering. So I like to use an analogy for mindfulness. It hit me at one point that mindfulness kind of functions like putting a car in neutral when it's going 65 miles an hour down the freeway. So, you know, you put the car in neutral when it's going down the freeway, and it's not going to stop. But you've stopped the forward momentum. You've stopped adding to the forward momentum of the car. So at some point of its own accord, it will slow down and come to a stop. And mindfulness kind of functions like that. When you bring your attention to the present moment, it doesn't stop what's happening. You just get to see very clearly your mind racing at 65 miles an hour with wanting, with aversion, with fear, with anxiety, with greed, with lust, with whatever is going on. But if we can essentially put our minds into neutral with mindfulness, not reacting, if we don't react to what we're experiencing, if we don't continue to feed it with thoughts, with moods, then it's like we put our minds in neutral and they will eventually come to a stop. The wanting will come to a stop. The suffering will come to a stop. It can sometimes take a very long time. Sometimes I think our minds are going at the speed of light, and it can take a long time to slow down. But if you stop adding to that forward momentum, it will eventually slow down. So naturally letting the mind stop means being present and non-reactive to whatever is happening. If suffering is present, we're present for that. We understand it. We bring our attention to it. We learn how it functions in our lives. If wanting is present, mindfulness helps us to be with it so that we don't act on it. The acting on the wanting is what essentially fuels it and keeps it going. So if we cannot act on the wanting, it can come to a stop. We don't actually have to do anything particular to try to realize the end of suffering, other than to be present. If we're present to understand suffering, if we put our minds in neutral, the car will come to a stop, the mind will come to a stop of its own accord. The mind realizes the end of suffering naturally as we bring our attention to the present moment. So also, for example, in wanting, it's the same thing. If we bring our attention to wanting and we don't act on it, we can see that wanting come to an end. The suffering doesn't have to follow on the heels of wanting. So an example of this in my own practice, I was on a 3-month course at IMS and was experiencing a lot of loneliness in this particular retreat. Just every time I turned around, it seems like loneliness. You know, nobody's talking to anybody and you can't make eye contact with anybody. You get to talk to a teacher once every 3 days for 10 minutes. That's your all contact with people. I mean, it was very lonely for me. And one day during lunch, I was sitting at lunch having, you know, just after I'd finished lunch, and I saw a thought go through my mind. The thought was, I was pretty present at this point, so I just saw the thought, and the thought was about being with a friend, having a lovely time with this friend. And I could see that, I mean, it was just a thought, but I could see that there was this movement of mind, this inclination of the mind to become lonely thinking about that thought. It was kind of shocking to me, actually. There was an actual desire for loneliness. It was a habitual pattern in my mind. It was something I knew, something I was familiar with, and the mind wanted to go there. Now, I had spent several weeks prior to this observing loneliness and seeing this is suffering in my body. So I understood that loneliness was suffering pretty well by that point. And when I saw the mind's inclination or wanting suffering, the mind just said, I don't think so. You know, I know where that's headed, and it's not pleasant, you know. So the mind just let go of that inclination. It just let it go. And that's because I had spent so much time paying attention to the suffering of loneliness that it did that. You know, it's that we really, I mean, it sounds kind of funny, but, you know, we really do have to be with our suffering. You know, we have to understand it. But if we do, the good news is it will end. It will at some point. So there's also times when we're mindful. And it doesn't particularly seem like there's a lot of suffering going on. So, you know, how come I'm not free? Or, you know, what's the deal here? You know, it doesn't seem like there's much suffering, but... Well, there's very subtle levels of suffering in our lives. And so the instructions of the Buddha point us to actually uncovering the subtlest levels of clinging in our lives. And he gave some very beautiful instructions about how to be present, what to pay attention to when the mind is fairly clear and not particularly suffering. So I'd like to share those two instructions with you. The first comes from a sutta, a famous sutta called the Bahiya Sutta. And it tells the story of a monk who had heard about the Buddha, and he was an ascetic. He'd practiced many, many ascetic practices and was fairly accomplished in those ascetic practices, but he'd heard about the Buddha and that the Buddha was completely free from suffering. So he wanted to learn what the Buddha knew. So he went to the Buddha to ask him about his instructions. And this is what the Buddha told him. These were the instructions he gave him. You should train yourself thus. In reference to the seen, there will be only the seen. In reference to the heard, only the heard. In reference to the sensed, only the sensed. In reference to the cognized, only the cognized. That is how you should train yourself. When for you, there will be only the seen in reference to the seen, only the heard in reference to the heard, only the sensed in reference to the sensed, only the cognized in reference to the cognized, then, Bahia, there is no you in terms of that. When there is no you in terms of that, there is no you there. When there is no you there, you are neither here nor yonder nor between the two. This, just this, is the end of stress. So in our current day language, what the Buddha is suggesting is bare attention. Attending to our physical and mental phenomenon without it being followed by a proliferation of thoughts and ideas. So for example, if we walk outside tomorrow and see a beautiful blue sky, after all of this rain, we see a beautiful blue sky. For a moment, there's just the blue. But almost immediately, this is probably followed by, oh, what a beautiful day. I'm so glad it finally stopped raining. Maybe we can have a picnic today. That would be really fun. We could go to this park that we went to last year when I had my birthday. And we are off. We're off and running. And we've lost the blue sky. We've lost the contact with our actual experience. And our lives are really lived this way, actually. You know, we have a moment of contact with something, a blue sky, a sweetness of an ice cream cone, a lovely sensation or texture on our hands, and we remember something. And we're off thinking about that. Oh, wasn't it great when I was at that bed and breakfast and those sheets? Weren't those sheets great? You know, just we go off. We don't stay in contact with our experience. It just quickly moves from our direct experience out into the world of thoughts. The term for this, I love the term for this in Pali, it's called papancha. Just to me, it sounds like what it is, papancha. So when we can rest in the bare experience of the moment, whether it's a sight, a simple arising of a mood, a thought, something touching our bodies, a taste, a sound, when we can contact that directly and not follow it by the proliferation of thoughts, and that takes some time, it does. I mean, you have to keep just coming back. It's just the practice. You notice the experience, and then you notice you're lost in thought. You come back and you notice the next thing, whatever is next. You notice you're lost in thought. You just come back over and over, just as much as possible, noticing what the experience is. And in that training, you're beginning to know what the experience of non-clinging is, because it's just the experience. There's nothing added to it. The second instruction I'd like to mention that the Buddha gives relates to the feeling of whether something is experienced as pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And I mentioned this last week that these feeling tones, the pleasant, the unpleasant, and the neutral, very naturally lead into reactivity. So if something is pleasant, we very naturally like it and want it. If something is unpleasant, we pretty naturally don't like it and want to push it away. It's a very natural response. You can see single-celled amoebas doing this. You know, it's not, you know, our human condition solely. It's really life's condition. So, you know, be compassionate and understanding with yourself about this response. It's very, very natural. But we've got the possibility as human beings, unlike amoebas, of actually witnessing the reactivity. We have this additional bit of consciousness in our experience, and that allows us the possibility to witness this movement. And allows us to see, oh, there's pleasant, oh, I don't like it, oh, I want to push it away. Unpleasant, don't like it, want to push it away. We can actually witness that. And with our attention, our bare attention, we can simply be with the pleasant or unpleasant. So here's the instructions that the Buddha gave on this. On seeing a form with the eye, he does not become greedy for pleasant forms or averse to disagreeable forms. He abides with mindfulness of the body, established, and with an immeasurable mind. Having abandoned the path of agreeing and disagreeing, he experiences whatever feeling arises, pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant, just as it is. He is not delighted or pleased with those feelings, and he does not appropriate them. Interest in those feelings ceases. With the cessation of interest, clinging ceases. So following this instruction, we just try to notice the pleasant and unpleasant aspects of experience and see if the attention can just rest there. Eating chocolate ice cream, this is pleasant. It's great to be experiencing the pleasant of eating chocolate ice cream. Stubbing your toe, this is unpleasant. Can we be with that sensation of unpleasant without adding the reactivity of, I'm so stupid, I should have been looking where I was going, or whatever reactivity follows along from that. If we can simply rest with the feeling of experience, the feeling tone of experience, pleasant, unpleasant, or neither, a deep sense of equanimity can develop. And wanting simply doesn't arise. It's possible to experience something pleasant without wanting to hold on to it, without wanting to grab it. You're just experiencing pleasant. You don't really need to do anything with that. You don't need to say, I really want to keep having this. How can I keep having this? We can experience something unpleasant just as unpleasant without adding all kinds of things on top of it, of hatred, of disgust, of anger, of frustration. This is actually possible. Looking at the feeling tone, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, helps us to break that cycle that I talked about last week of pleasant, liking, wanting, having, suffering, pleasant, liking, wanting, having, suffering, unpleasant, disliking, not wanting, not pushing away. It breaks into that cycle at that place of pleasant or unpleasant and just lets it stop right there. I find this instruction, recalling this instruction, even if it's just a mental recollection, a reflection, if I can't actually do it, it's helpful sometimes to just think about it. So if I'm stuck at a stoplight and I feel that I'm impatient about being stuck at that stoplight, I can reflect, well, you know, this impatience, this is unpleasant. Yeah, you know, I can feel the unpleasantness. I can feel the sense of tension in the body, that's unpleasant. I can feel the sense of not wanting to be in this place, wanting to be someplace else, that's unpleasant. Just really recognizing what is unpleasant about the experience. That investigation begins to help me and to help me realize that that wanting what I don't have is suffering. It helps me to recognize that, and it helps me to let go of wanting to be someplace else than sitting at the stoplight. I don't have a choice. I'm stuck at the stoplight. So through our mindfulness practice, we start to witness moments, as Linda mentioned earlier, moments of seeing something let go, of the wanting, it just goes away. And we begin to realize that it's actually possible to feel the end of suffering. We get these moments, these hints of what's possible. And that inspires us to continue. It really gives us the passion for continuing the practice because we've witnessed that it works. Gil told a story one Sunday morning that it really stuck with me at one point. He said, imagine that you have a linoleum floor and it's really dirty. You know, an old linoleum floor, how filthy they get. And he said, you decide, I really want to clean this floor. So you spend the effort, you work on one square inch of this floor. You know, you really put your effort into it. You scrub and you scrub, really, you know, all kinds of different cleansers, working really hard. And after a long time, you find out, wow, it's clean. That little tiny bit is clean. So it's possible, you see, wow, it's possible to clean this floor. It's actually possible. And then you meet somebody who tells you that they've cleaned theirs, and you know that it's possible. So it really, you know, not only these little bits that we see ourselves, but meeting people who demonstrate this in their lives also can help to inspire us. So I do want to just say that these moments of release that we feel, like I described in my story about the loneliness, that the fact that I saw the inclination towards loneliness and the mind just let it go. I mean, it let it go kind of like a hand lets go of a pot. that's hot on the stove, it kind of automatically lets it go because the body knows suffering is going to follow. Well, as you are with suffering long enough, the mind has a similar reaction. It will automatically let go of the suffering because it knows where it's going. So we're inspired to continue with our practice. But these moments, these little moments that I describe, my understanding is those are not nibbana. Those are hints of nibbana. Gil gives another analogy that I like about nibbana. He talks about this can. He said, imagine there was a can and it's been sitting out and it's had a little bit of water in the bottom of this can. And so, you know, you dump the water out and you notice that the bottom of the can is all rusty. So your life is kind of like this can, just the bottom of the can is rusty. And, you know, at first when we're in our practice, we're really in the bottom of that can where there's all this grit and grime and everything's really yucky and unpleasant. And you're just slugging along in that place, noticing how unpleasant it is. And as we practice, we kind of move up the sides of the can a little bit. You know, it gets a little smoother up at the top. You know, it's not as much rusted there because the water wasn't there. So now you're kind of smoothly gliding along on the can, and things seem pretty good, you know. Gil says that Nibbana has no reference to the can whatsoever. None. Just nothing at all to do with the can. So I'll just leave you with that. So, but these moments do let us know that we're on the path. You know, they give us the clue that this is the right direction. We can witness that the mind lets go. We see that we're headed towards less suffering in our lives. We witness the experience of more smoothness in our lives, even if we are still in that can. It's fine. You know, we are really know we are on the path because we've seen the practice works. So I'll just talk for a couple of minutes about the path, just to give you an overview of it. I'll talk in detail about it next week, but it's such a big topic that I don't think I can do it all in 1 week. So I'll just give you a little overview of the Eightfold Path. So the fourth noble truth is the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering. And this is the prescription that the Buddha gave to us to follow so that we can, for ourselves, see the end of suffering. The fourth noble truth, the Buddha said, is meant to be cultivated. It is meant to be developed. So these qualities of mind that I'm going to begin to describe a little this week, and we'll go into more detail next week, these are the qualities that will help us towards freedom. So this path is meant to be cultivated, and we have to do the work for ourselves. There's a quote from the Dhammapada that's very beautiful that I love, that I'll read. Just this is the path. There is no other to purify vision. Following it, you put an end to suffering and stress. I have taught you this path for knowing the extraction of arrows. It is for you to strive ardently. Tathagatas simply point out the way. And Tathagata is the Buddha's name for himself and for any enlightened, not quite any enlightened being, the extremely Buddha-enlightened beings. So this path leading to the cessation of suffering has eight components, and they are usually listed in order as right understanding, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So this ordered list, and it is listed in this order pretty much everywhere it's seen in the suttas, leads us sometimes to think that it's a linear path, that we have to do the first one, and then the second one, and then the third one. But this isn't the case, really, as a reflection on the first factor, right understanding, will show us immediately. Because as we read what the definition of right understanding is, the basic definition of right understanding is a deep and complete understanding of the Four Noble Truths. And that only happens after you're enlightened. So the fact that it's first on the Eightfold Path is kind of interesting, you know, because it is actually the culmination of the path. So essentially the path is circular. We have to have some knowledge of some aspects of understanding the Four Noble Truths to even get onto the path. We mostly, I think, come to a practice, many of us come to a practice or spiritual seeking because there's something we're looking for, something, some suffering, some feeling that there's got to be a way to end this. And a little bit of that, that's a tiny bit of understanding of the Four Noble Truths. There is suffering, there's got to be a way to end this. So that little seed is there. And we kind of follow this eightfold path. It's an eightfold, I look at it, you know, it really does fold upon itself. But as we go through them, we contact each of them in deeper and deeper ways. It kind of spirals down to deeper and deeper understandings of each of the eightfold factors of the eightfold path, until at the end, we come back to right understanding with a full understanding of the Four Noble Truths. So the eightfold path, as I said, it kind of indicates that they fold on top of each other. And an examination of one of the factors, for instance, right speech or wholesome speech, sometimes I prefer to call it, can give us a clue as to how these all interact. So, for instance, with wholesome speech, we at least need right intention, the intention to speak wholesomely. We need right effort, the effort to cultivate that intention and that movement. We need right mindfulness to know what we're going to say before we say it. So all of these things come together in the cultivation of right speech. But that said, there is a kind of a partial ordering to the Eightfold Path that can help us to reveal a kind of a general direction for our practice. And the Buddha often stated that the ground, the basis of our practice, should rest on ethical conduct. The base of ethical conduct, that base, supports the training of the mind in concentration, in mindfulness. If we don't have our act cleaned up in terms of ethics, you know, it can be very difficult to sit down and meditate because your mind is continually kind of running around. If you've just lied to somebody, for instance, if you sit down to meditate, you may find your mind going all over the place about, oh, what about that person? That person knows that person. I better remember to tell that person not to tell that person. Your mind can kind of go nuts. So we really kind of need to be working on that base of ethical conduct in order to allow the mind to settle in meditation and concentration. And from that base of concentration and mindfulness, wisdom will come. So there's that general direction in our practice. We cultivate ethics and train the mind, and wisdom follows. So the Eightfold Path fits into this framework of gradual training. So sila, or ethics, there are three factors of the path that comprise that: right speech, right action, and right livelihood. Concentration, or the training of the mind, is comprised of right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And the wisdom aspect of the path is comprised of right understanding and right intention. So I'll talk a little bit more about that next week. And I left a few minutes for some comments or questions, if anybody has anything to say or anything at all. Oh, here it is.
Now, can you hear? Okay. Couple thoughts. One is regarding the importance of ethics. I've found that personally it's been helpful when I get into one of those mindsets of oh, did I say something wrong? Did I, you know, should I have done things differently? Sometimes I just call myself back to, okay, was my action ethical? And if it was ethical, it was good enough.
Yeah, that's a really great basis for looking at some of our, especially when we get really wavering about, oh, should I have done that? Shouldn't I have done that? The Dalai Lama says something kind of similar. You know, he says, he's made all kinds of choices in his life, and some of them have led to really, you know, painful outcomes. He has made the decision not to fight, and the Chinese army comes in and, you know, mows down his monks, you know. So he has made decisions that lead to really really painful outcomes. And somebody asked him once, how do you work with that? And he said, my skillful intention is my refuge. So the fact that he is basically choosing as best he can from the most skillful intention that he can, that's how he lives with the consequences. I mean, we cannot control the consequences of our actions, but we can know what our intention is. And so if we can act from skillful intentions, we can have a peaceful mind as much as possible.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things I was struggling with this week was just returning from a week of vacation and discovering depression hitting almost immediately when I was at work. And that feeling of a number of things that bother me at work. And part of me was saying, well, maybe what I need to do is get desensitized to some of these triggers, that they don't bother me. And then I talked to a friend about it, and she said, well, no, you're in a bad situation. Really what you should be doing is finding another job. And part of your problem may be that your boss is actually not as smart as you are, and there's difficulty with that. And that sort of made me wonder if there are some teachings having to do with dealing with people that are stupider than you are when they're your boss, because you can feel compassion for them and all that, but that there's sort of like a reality there that won't go away.
Yeah,
so I'm curious if you have anything to say about that.
The teachings of the mindfulness it's not a teaching of passive passivity. It really is a teaching of paying attention. I mean, with that attention, we can begin to see, oh, this is not a good situation for me. I need to change. I mean, it doesn't mean we sit there in that situation and just say, it's like this, it's like this, it's like this. I mean, we use discernment. We use our wisdom and intelligence to make decisions, but not from reactivity necessarily, not from hatred or aversion or frustration, but just a sort of a say, well, okay, this is the situation. I've got these kinds of options. I could maybe talk to my boss's boss. I could, do other find another job within the same company, or, you know, just what are my options? But not so much from reactivity. The mindfulness helps us to cut through the reactivity so that we're not unskillful in our actions. But the Buddhist teachings are not one of passivity. So you really do just have to use your own discernment. But it is within yourself to look at that discernment. I don't know that there's any particular teachings about what to do in given situations, but except to just look at the situation and look at what the options are without reactivity.
Okay.
Yeah.
The way you asked the question, this has been a question for me.
How do you see the difference between the release of attachments and desensitization? How are those? Are they the same thing?
Define desensitization to me.
It's kind of become a term of vogue, I guess, in talking about things like TV desensitizes us to violence. Getting you the whole idea
kind of
just
numb to it,
numbing, yeah. Just mm-hmm. Getting used to something by seeing it over and over and over again, and eventually there's no reactivity. How is that the same or different from this release of attachments?
Well, I think that place of numbness is really a place of delusion. You know, it's not clarity of mind. Because, I mean, I myself know, I was pretty desensitized to violence through watching movies and stuff. I mean, I remember watching Die Hard and thinking it was a great movie. And, you know, I have so much trouble going to a lot of movies these days. So that, you know, the clear seeing of experience, I see what actually I see happening now is that images of violence appear in my mind after I've seen movies, and they're really unsettling and disturbing. So I have seen myself through the training of mindfulness become resensitized, essentially. So, you know, that desensitization is one of delusion. It's numbing. So it's not one of wisdom. It doesn't include wisdom. It's really one of ignorance. And that's the difference. In my view, that the letting go that happens when you know when the mind releases a suffering, because it knows that it just needs to, like the hand releases the pot, because it knows where it's going if it holds on to it. When the mind releases it, it's the wisdom of the mind doing that. It's not delusion that does that. So that to me is the difference. So I wanted to just suggest a couple of things for you to try for this week. So last couple of weeks I've been suggesting looking at suffering and wanting. This week, since we're talking about the cessation of suffering, what I'd like to suggest you do is see if you can notice times that you're not suffering. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean when you're happy. This may be times where you're not even paying attention. I mean, these moments of non-suffering often are unnoticed by us. So, you know, I mentioned the sitting at a traffic light earlier, you know, that kind of impatience I had. Well, now when I'm sitting at a traffic light, if I bring my attention to sitting at a traffic light, I often just notice, oh, there's nothing much happening, you know, there's nothing wrong. I'm not deliriously happy, but, you know, there's nothing wrong. I'm not suffering here. So just notice those moments when you're not suffering. And places to check for this are in between times, like when you've just finished a meal and you're getting up before, you know, right before you get up to go clear the table. You know, just these moments, you've got the satisfaction of having finished the meal and you're not yet propelled into the next thing. These in-between times is a good place to check for this non-suffering. So just check and see if you can notice those. What's happening? What's going on in those moments? Peace can be a really subtle feeling, and we don't really appreciate it as much as we could. The second exercise does have to do with looking for moments of wholesome feelings, gratitude, happiness, joy, generosity, kindness. So it's just to notice them when they arise and see what they feel like. What is the experience? Appreciating these wholesome emotions is a very important part of this practice. I don't think that's really emphasized enough. I mean, I at least was the kind of person that would overlook these things entirely. I was so focused on the negative that I would miss completely when I was happy. I had this one experience of driving down the road and I was just noticing that I was caught in this incredible planning frenzy. I've got to do this and this and this and this and this. And it's like, whoa, wow, where's that coming from? I brought my attention back to the driving. And then, boom, I was off again in this planning frenzy. And this happened a couple times, and I just had to stop and say, what is going on here? You know, just kind of a broad attention. What is happening here? I was really happy. And the mind was working overtime trying to figure out how to keep it. And I missed the happiness entirely. I just completely. So, you know, really recognize and appreciate these positive, wholesome emotions when they arise. You can actually look for them. It's okay to look for them. You know, and feel them. Let them sink into your body. It's a very important part of cultivating this path. So those are my thoughts for this evening. And I wish you many moments of happiness and non-suffering this week. Thank you.